School is out, but an infectious virus common in children isn't taking a break. The Cincinnati Health Department is warning parvovirus is on the rise in Hamilton County. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WBXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me now to talk about how the virus is transmitted, the risks of infection, and how to prevent it is University of Cincinnati Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology, Dr. Kara Markham. Welcome, Dr. Markham.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We appreciate your being here. And still with us from our previous discussion is immediate past president of the Ohio chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, Dr. Chris Peltier. Thanks for sticking around, Dr. Peltier.
Thanks for the invite again.
Dr. Markham, what is parvovirus?
Parvovirus is a virus, you know, as it's said to be. It typically causes a viral type syndrome, most frequently in children. They can present with, you know, just feeling general malaise, fatigue, and kind of the most common thing we think of, the thing we're taught in medical school to associate this with parvovirus is a rash on the cheeks, kind of a lacy red rash, and they call it a slapped cheek appearance. And usually in children, it's benign. It doesn't really just kind of runs its course. You just need to support them through it, but they'll be fine. But the problem is that it can cause more severe issues for people who are immunocompromised or individuals who are pregnant.
Mm. We'll talk more about that. Dr. Peltier, how is parvovirus transmitted?
It's a great question, Lucy. So it's really like many viruses, spread by droplets. So respiratory droplets, so coughing, sneezing, very, very common way that it's spread. And it's very seasonal. So we typically in our office will see parvovirus, which goes by many names. As you know, Dr. Markham said, sometimes we call it the slap cheek disease. You may hear it called fifth disease. It was actually the fifth viral rash named, and that's why it's historically called fifth disease. The medical name is actually erythema infectiosum. And we typically see parvovirus usually beginning late winter, springtime, and kind of through the summer. And about every 3 or 4 years or so, we sort of get this sort of more of a epidemic and see higher numbers.
Hmm. Dr. Markham, when we first heard about this in our newsroom, some of us thought, isn't that a dog thing? Is this the same virus that dogs can get, or is it a different strain?
Dogs can also get a disease called parvovirus, but it's a different strain.
Okay.
And dogs are not susceptible to the human form, nor are humans susceptible to the canine form.
Okay, good to know. Good to know. So if you're a little sick kid, it's sneezing in your dog's face, that is not going to cause a problem, and vice versa, I guess.
Correct.
So Dr. Markham, what kind of outbreak are we seeing locally with parvovirus?
To be honest, we don't really know. It's not a reportable disease. So pediatricians don't need to report it. It's not reported to the health department. We don't know the numbers. What we know is the downstream effects, specifically in pregnancy. And I've been a high-risk obstetrician for going on 15 years now, and I would say typically I see about one case of fetal parvovirus a year. And we've seen several cases in this area in the past 2 to 3 months.
Mm. And how do you detect that there's a case of fetal parvovirus?
A number of different ways. Some women will come to their obstetrician and say, hey, there's been a parvovirus outbreak at my child's school. I'm worried. That's the best case scenario because that allows us to detect early on that she's at risk for her baby being affected by parvovirus and to start a really good monitoring program. Another possibility, the disease tends to be at its worst right around the time that a lot of women will have what we call their anatomy ultrasound, where we look for abnormalities of the heart, the brain, that sort of thing. So some women will present because we see that the baby's very sick when they come to this ultrasound.
And you can tell that on the ultrasound.
Yes. Babies can develop something called hydrops. They become so anemic that they develop sort of a form of heart failure, and they develop fluid in the abdomen, fluid around the heart, fluid around the lungs, increased skin fluid. Those are very sick babies, and ideally we would recognize this well before we got to that point.
That sounds very scary. I mean, that must be a terrifying thing for a mom to discover during an ultrasound.
It is. It's terrifying because we have to be honest in those cases that by the time you get to this hydrops type picture, there's a very high risk that the baby will die, even with our best attempts. Now, we can save these babies' lives, but it definitely – can be an uphill battle for a little while.
We're talking about parvovirus and the rising number of cases in Hamilton County. Do you have questions or comments? Give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. Dr. Peltier, you were talking about how you see this in your office as kind of a seasonal thing, that kids tend to get it. What is your advice when you have a sick child in your practice? Is part of this to educate the parent, especially if there's a mom who's trying to have another baby or might be pregnant? Is that something that's part of your routine?
Definitely. So, you know, one of the challenging things when it comes to parvovirus is that a child is contagious before the rash appears. And as Dr. Markham said, kids usually don't have a lot of other symptoms. They may get mild low-grade fever. They may feel a little achy, as opposed to adults that usually feel kind of achy. They feel pretty miserable. They're achy for a few days. But kids don't really know they have the virus. And that's when they're actually shedding the virus and can infect somebody else that has never been exposed or, you know, doesn't have immunity against parvovirus. Once the rash appears, that usually signals the end of the infectious part. So again, it's hard because a child may have been around a pregnant mom and nobody had any clue that the child was sick. So when I do see a child, you know, with parvovirus, I explain it exactly like Dr. Markham said, that this is a self-limiting illness, that it will sort of, the rash will fade on its own in a few days to a week. But I do ask them, I'll say, has your child been around any moms who are pregnant? Because if they are, they should call their obstetrician and discuss testing and some other things that Dr. Markham would do. The other is, Dr. Markham had also mentioned immunocompromised children. So if, or adults. So if you have a family member that either has is born with an immunodeficiency or maybe getting chemotherapy, there's potential that those similar to babies in utero can have significant issues with anemia. So I always ask them, that's the other question I'll ask, because they've been around anybody that whose immune system is compromised.
Dr. Markham, you were just talking about these, you know, scary kind of worst case scenarios that can happen for people who are pregnant and their babies are exposed. How common is that, or how rare is that?
So if we take 100 pregnant individuals, about half will have been exposed in the past and are immune. So that leaves 50 pregnant individuals. Of those 50, about 60% of babies will not be infected for some reason. So that leaves basically 20 babies that will be infected and are at risk for developing disease. Of those 20 babies, probably around 10% will become very sick and will die. So it's not, the numbers are on our side. It's only 2 out of 100 babies, if you play with those numbers, that mom hasn't been exposed, isn't immune, the baby becomes infected, and the fetus becomes ill. The problem is that of those 2 babies, at least one, if not both, will die if they don't receive the appropriate treatment.
What is the appropriate treatment?
We give the baby blood. So we start, if a mom's been exposed or we're worried about parvovirus, we start by checking the mom's immune status. There are 2 types of antibodies we look for, IgG and IgM. If IgM is positive, that indicates that the mom has probably been recently infected with parvovirus. So then we can start ultrasound monitoring to screen for the baby being anemic, because that's what parvovirus causes. It attacks the baby's bone marrow to shut down production of red blood cells and platelets. And we can actually use ultrasound to screen for anemia. And if we identify that the baby is anemic, we take a needle, we go through the mom's abdomen, and we insert the needle into, ideally, the baby's umbilical cord and give the baby a blood transfusion. And it can be life-saving.
Yeah. Are there risks associated with that? I imagine. Yeah. I mean, I know when I was pregnant, the thought of needles going in there was a little bit scary to me.
Absolutely, especially because fetuses are most at risk for this at less than 20 weeks, and that's the time when these procedures are most risky. It's also, if we have a baby that has that high drops picture, a very sick baby that's not going to necessarily have the reserve that a healthier baby would have. So there's definitely risks that we still have a death despite the treatment, risks of preterm labor, the water breaking early delivery. Those risks aren't high, but it's about 1 to 3% with each procedure.
Dr. Markham, you were talking about one of the ways that this can be detected is in that at that ultrasound appointment, and if the baby is very sick, you can see it that way. Is there an earlier detection model? I mean, do you ever try to take blood from the fetus to determine if they got it earlier on?
No, ideally we wouldn't do that because, again, there are risks with that. But the good news is that there's a non-invasive screening method using ultrasound to screen for anemia. It relies on the fact that if a baby is anemic, has a low number of red blood cells, it still wants to carry oxygen to all the tissues. So one of the ways it does that is by increasing the rapidity of blood flow, particularly in the brain, because that's such an important organ. So we can measure how fast the blood flow is in a specific artery in the brain and compare that to babies at the same gestational age in order to estimate if the baby or screen, I should say, if the baby is anemic or not. Fast blood flow raises concerns for anemia, and in that case, that's when we think about doing the needle procedure.
Hmm. Dr. Peltier, is there a vaccine for parvovirus or another way to prevent transmission or ever getting it in the first place?
Yeah, unfortunately, there is no vaccine for parvovirus. I am not aware of any trials where there are looking to make a vaccine against parvovirus. I will say, unfortunately, I'm not sure, just because of the fact that most kids, most people that get parvovirus, it is a benign illness, obviously very serious and tragic when it happens to a fetus, but I'm not sure that there's impetus for a manufacturer, unfortunately, to make a virus for this. Dr. Markham, can I ask you a question? Just one of the things I've been thinking about, because I see this in my office. I have a mom that's pregnant, and there's definitely that panic moment until they have that appointment with you. Has there been any talk about sort of guidelines on, when you're first doing, you're coming for that first obstetric appointment and drawing baseline labs? Has there ever been any talk about routinely screening for parvovirus so that parents at least know if they're exposed, they're okay?
Yeah, there are definitely populations in which we have a low threshold to screen for immunity status, such as daycare workers or teachers. It's not necessarily routinely done because we can't prevent infection even if we find that a mom is susceptible, other than continuing to recommend, aggressive hygiene, basically.
Sure. And aggressive hygiene, I assume that's hand washing.
Hand washing, exactly. Washing fruits and vegetables, that sort of thing.
What about masking with cases on the rise? Is that, I know a lot of people are real tired of hearing about masking after the COVID-19 pandemic, but what about that?
Yeah, that could be a very effective at preventing parvovirus.
Yeah. Is that something that, if you are a pregnant daycare worker or preschool teacher, or I'm thinking it's probably adults who are in contact with younger kids who are more terrible about, sneezing in your face and that sort of thing. Is it recommended to just mask all the time?
It's not necessarily recommended because we know how onerous that can be. I think certainly if there's an outbreak in a daycare, then daycare workers should be masking. But by the time that's recognized, it may already be too late to make much of a difference. Mm. But it wouldn't be wrong to mask regardless.
Yeah. Again, we're talking about parvovirus and the rising number of cases in Hamilton County. You can join the conversation. Call 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. Dr. Markham, you mentioned this, and Dr. Peltier referred to it too, about the dangers for people who have compromised immune systems. I read that this can be linked to autoimmune diseases in other ways too. Can it trigger an autoimmune response? What's the connection there?
I'll be honest that I don't know details about that. Mm-hmm. Certainly any virus can trigger autoimmune issues for patients who already have that condition or have that condition and don't know about it.
Mm-hmm. And we've talked about the...
Go ahead.
Oh, Dr. Peltier, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I've not seen any pediatric studies that have linked that. Again, as Dr. Markham said, definitely viruses definitely can you know, affect the immune system and sometimes can trigger autoimmune responses, but I've not seen any in either my patients or any sort of case reports in pediatrics.
Okay. And what about for people who have autoimmune disorders? You talked about how this can be more serious for them too, or I think I'm remembering that correctly.
Immunocompromised individuals.
Yes, mm-hmm. I'm sorry, immunocompromised individuals. What does that mean for people, say, who have sickle cell anemia or other conditions like that? Can that be a bigger cause for worry?
I assume it can cause worse symptoms, possibly even could cause more severe disease for them. But I'll be honest that that's not my area of expertise.
Yeah, yes. Fair enough.
I can take that one.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, please. You know, probably the biggest population in pediatrics we see it in, because luckily we don't see a lot of kids with immunodeficiencies, but there are a lot of children with sickle cell disease. And in sickle cell disease, it can cause what we call an aplastic crisis, which Dr. Markham very sort of nicely sort of spelled out. The virus attacks the bone marrow, which prevents it from creating red blood cells. And so people with sickle cell already have sort of an issue because many of the red blood cells are deformed and don't work as well carrying oxygen. So whenever a sickle cell patient is sort of exposed to parvo, I always recommend them, just like I would refer a mom to their obstetrician, I always have the parents call their child's hematologist to discuss sort of next steps.
What are the additional complications that those children can face, Dr. Peltier? I mean, do you see different kinds of symptoms from them if they do contract parvovirus?
Yeah, so Dr. Markham said it really is just sort of worsening of their symptoms. So it can cause sort of respiratory problems again, because if you're not producing red blood cells, your tissues aren't getting enough oxygen. So that can lead to respiratory and cardiac issues. And then also one of the biggest issues with sickle cell disease are when patients develop pain crises, because sort of the misformed red blood cells sort of clog up the small blood vessels, and it can be very, very painful, and that can exacerbate that. So, and then just generally, if you've ever been anemic, you know, it's just, you have just sort of this really big fatigue and just have no energy. And so that all sort of compounds, and kids can get pretty sick if they have sickle cell disease and contract parvo. Mm.
Dr. Markham, I know you said that the parvo is not a reportable disease, so there aren't really solid numbers on cases or, you know, on this kind of apparent outbreak. So this might be one of those mysterious questions too, but do we have any idea what the reason is behind this apparently higher number of cases?
No. I mean, partly, like we said, it's seasonal. We know that. It's a highly contagious virus. So if one person happens to get it from their friend in California, one child, then it can easily kind of run rampant throughout the school or the daycare.
Hmm. Okay. I wonder, Dr. Peltier, is there any thought that some of this could be a byproduct of the COVID-19 pandemic? I mean, I was reading, you know, with so many other things, fewer of us built up resistance to different viruses because of the measures we were taking to avoid COVID infections. Do you think that could be playing a role in this at all, Dr. Peltier?
That's a really good question. And, you know, we definitely did see that early on when we sort of first came out of sort of the shutdown from the pandemic. And probably the biggest thing we saw was the shift in respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV, that typically is a late fall wintertime virus. We were actually seeing that in June and July and August. We were seeing that in the summer. And we really thought that was probably due to kids not going to school and being in daycares. I don't think we've seen, and again, it's hard to say because, as Dr. Markham said, we don't report this. I was actually went to the Cincinnati Children's website today that will sort of show what different pathogens are out there, and it's not listed because it's not really a reportable disease. So to my knowledge, we have not seen sort of a big outbreak. We do tend to get these outbreaks every 3 to 4 years, and we don't know why that happens. It could be that there is some, just like COVID, right, there could be some mutations in the virus that do make it more infective. That's a possibility, but I don't think we really know. But to my knowledge, I think this is one thing that I'm not comfortably certain we could say we could blame on COVID.
Mm-hmm. And it's possible that if there is a mutation in the virus, that one of those mutations could make fetuses more susceptible. So perhaps that's why we're seeing an uptick in fetal infections right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Yeah. Dr. Markham, you know, we've talked about some really scary stuff. You said the numbers are on our side, but if you're the mom who is that person who loses her baby, that's an awful outcome, terrifying. What do you recommend to people who might be listening about this and say, I want to do everything I can to be as safe as I can to protect the baby I'm carrying as much as I can?
So first of all, just in easing anxiety, I would say if you're after 20 weeks of pregnancy and you become infected, for some reason, those babies are able to handle things better. So this really is a disease of the first half of pregnancy. The second would be awareness that this is a problem, potentially, in pregnancy, education about that. And if you know that there's an outbreak or your pediatrician, informs you there's an outbreak, notify your obstetrician so that they can take you down the pathway that will best assure that we can keep your baby safe.
Yeah. And Dr. Peltier, what should parents do if this is going around their child's school or daycare?
Yeah, that's a great question. And again, unfortunately, there's not a lot to do because most of the time, the infectious period is before you realize that you're sick because there are very few symptoms in kids. And as I said earlier, once you develop that rash that sort of often starts on the cheeks, that slap cheek, but then it sort of spreads. And it's, as Dr. Markham described it, it's a very lacy, it's a rash that you cannot feel. So it's not a bumpy rash, it's a flat rash that you can't feel. Once that rash develops, the child's really not contagious anymore. So, again, just good hygiene, right? So things we would normally say, wash your hands, try not to put your hands in your mouth or your nose. That's really goes for sort of just viral prevention in general, not necessarily specific for parvo. But unfortunately, that's about the best that we have.
Okay. Always good advice to wash your hands. I've been talking with University of Cincinnati Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology, Dr. Kara Markham, and immediate past president of the Ohio chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, Dr. Chris Peltier. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez-Cornu. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.